Good morning, and welcome to Hour 1 of the F-Word on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio. This is Vancouver's only feminist radio program, and for a while we'll be on the air from 7 to 9 in the morning on Saturdays, rather than only from 8 to 9. I'm Nicole Deegan, and thank you for joining me here this morning. So each week from 7 to 8, I play pre-recorded feminist material, and our second hour from 8 to 9 is the same as always, often with live interviews and discussion of current events. Today in hour 2, we'll be interviewing Elle Jones, a spoken word artist from Halifax, and Angela McDougall from BWSS. We'll be speaking about hip-hop and rap. First, I'm going to play a section of a recording of an interview by We Act, Women Elders in Action. Their website is weact.vcn.bc.ca, so that's weact.vcn.bc.ca. And this is an interview they did with Bev Mill from Nelson, who is the only female freedom rider in the U.S. South during the 60s. She talks about what that activism meant to her then and how she currently expresses her social justice impulses. I'll be back in a few minutes with that interview. If you have any comments or thoughts on what you're hearing, feel free to drop me an email at feminisms@gmail.com. That's feminism with an S on the end at gmail.com. Again, I'm Nicole Deegan. You're listening to Hour 1 of the F Word on Vancouver's Cooperative Radio Station, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Filled with crocodiles.
Good morning and welcome to the F Word on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. So I'm going to start playing the interview from We Act that I was speaking about. So this is Women Elders in Action, and they interviewed Bev Mill from Nelson, who was the only female freedom rider in the U.S. South during the 60s, and she'll be talking about what activism means to her then and how she currently expresses her social justice impulses. If you have any comments or thoughts on what you're hearing, feel free to drop me an email at feminisms@gmail.com. Again, I'm Nicole Deegan, and you're listening to Hour 1 of the F Word on Vancouver's cooperative radio station, CFRO.
I've listened to how one woman has learned to transform pain into a kind of universal language, the language of dissent through her art. With our next guest, we will confront annihilation in another guise. Racism annihilates the humaneness in a person, in an individual. When one person regards another as lesser than he is, this person denies not only the physical presence of the other, but is total humanity, having the same rights and worth as anyone else. Bev Mill encountered this form of annihilation away from home. She was the only Canadian woman to join the Freedom Riders in the American South in 1961. She's currently retired from her work as an X-ray technologist, specializing in mammography and pediatrics. Bev Mel lives in Nelson, where she is active in the Go-Go Grannies, the Company of Older Women, and the Nelson Peace Coalition. She's busy recording stories for We Act's Lessons Learned project. I caught up with Bev Mel at the workshop for Lessons Learned, which she attended last month at 411 Senior Center. I had just watched the night before a documentary on her that CBC Television produced. And the DVD is what I used as take-off point in our conversation.
Because I've watched the DVD, and I have seen and heard what you've done. But I suppose there are things right there that needs telling. And I would like to know that part where you did a turnaround.
I'm not exactly sure at what point in my life that my life took a big turn, but for sure it did. It could have been when I was training in the hospital in St. John, New Brunswick, and they said, who would like to go to Boston to study pediatric radiography? And I just knew right away, and I put my hand up and I said, me, I want to go. So that hospital sent me to the United States, to Boston, as an exchange student. And that's why I say I always think of it as doors opening, right? I felt like there was a door opening, and it was a way to get out of town, get away from my family, who were very controlling, and start my life, you know, without anybody telling me what to do. So, you know, that felt like a beginning or something. So then I went to Boston, and I was invited to go with a bunch of other people to the hospital next door for lunch. And during lunch, this man who sat there, and he was staring at me a lot. And then he leans over and he says, would you like to come to my house Friday night for a party? And before I could answer, he said, well, if you don't like kikes, bicks, wops, or kinks, or niggers, don't come. And it just took me back, because those are all words that, you know, you don't ever use. And when I realized what he was saying, I said, yeah, I'm coming. And he was telling me that this was like a multi-ethnic party, and if you don't like multi-ethnic people, don't come. So I went to that party, and that was another door opening. You know, it was all students, university students. It was sort of the end of the beatnik era, and young people becoming political. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, I mean, at this party, I mean, there were people representing all kinds of ethnicities and playing great music and dancing and drinking, and I hadn't done any of those things. So I just felt like a little bumpkin from Canada with my bobby socks and saddle shoes. And they were all, people were all dressed up and they're dancing and having this great time. Well, I just said, this is for me, you know? And it was this man's roommate at this apartment was that man that I subsequently married, who was my first husband, who, again, was another door opening. And this was a man who, he was Jewish. My family were anti-Jewish. And I married him, and my family didn't speak to me for 11 years that I was married to him. But he was probably maybe the biggest influence in my life, because he introduced me to all kinds of music, to jazz, to folk music. He took me to the opera. He took me to foreign films in foreign languages that I had never been to in Canada. I always lived in a small town. They never had anything like a foreign film.
Yes, that was what I was going to go into. If you thought this was a new world opening for you, could you give a picture of the old world that closed behind you?
Well, I came from farm people from Alberta, Protestant, very narrow-minded, white culture, aside from growing up very close to Native Indian people who, in my first years in school, I never had any Indian children that I went to school with. But in the first two grades, right across the street was an Indian reservation. And I could look out the window and see the children over there playing all day. They weren't in school because they didn't go to school. So, you know, it's coming from the sort of Bible Belt in Alberta, you know, farmers for a couple of generations and immigrants, and very narrow in their views of the world. And I came from that.
And were you conscious of the dichotomy?
I was conscious because in church, I actually believed what they said in church. And I remember once looking at this bulletin in the church, and it had the picture of an African man on the front. And I'd never seen a person of color like that. And I kept looking at this picture, and we would collect money to send to Africa. And I kept looking at this picture, and I thought, this is the most beautiful looking human being I've ever seen. And so I got, when I was in high school, I got a pen pal in Africa, and my father teased me all the time. You know, in a very racist way. And so I didn't like that. And so I was already on a path. The other thing that happened that sort of separated me from the background was that I started listening to a shortwave radio at night when I was in high school in St. John, New Brunswick. And I actually heard Fidel Castro broadcast from Cuba before the revolution was successful. And at the same time, I was also listening to a radio station from New York City that played rhythm and blues and jazz and rock and roll. And I was like this person just percolating to find out what life was about, because I thought, wow, where did all this come from? Mm-hmm. You know? So when I went to Boston and I met all these interesting people and met my first husband, and the fact that he was Jewish, many of his friends were black, African Americans. In fact, when we got married, most of the people standing up with us were African American. And my mother and my sister came, and my father refused to come. And it was made me really sensitive about racism. And it was also a time in the whole world where people in Africa were fighting for independence from the colonial powers. So there was revolution all over the world. There was in Southeast Asia, you know, in Vietnam and Cambodia, people were struggling to get rid of the French. And it was the time of the Cuban Revolution. and the Algerian Revolution and the revolution in China, and all these people, Ho Chi Minh, Mao Zedong, Fidel Castro, were coming to power, these great leaders of independence, and I thought, and what I felt was a democratic change. They were leaving colonialism and dictatorship. So I was influenced by all of that. You know, that's what was on the news. And the civil rights movement in the United States started. And because I associated with lots of these people, my mind was just going, you know, a mile a minute, you know, absorbing everything and making me look at my values. And I think there was one incident that crystallized for me where I stood, and that was a bunch of us were going out one night to a concert or to a movie or something, and we decided to stop in a bar for a drink. And there was one African-American man with us, and he said, oh, I don't want to go in there, that's an Irish bar, which in Boston would mean a racist bar. Black people would never go in an Irish bar. And we said, you know, what can happen to you? We're all together. So we sat at the bar and had a drink. And then when we finished and paid, nobody said anything. The bartender reached under the counter and pulled out a big, like a baseball bat, and smashed his glass so that no one would ever have to drink out of a glass that a black man had drunk out of. Nothing was ever said. And so we were shaking when we walked out of there. It was like, wow, I really learned something here about how deep and nasty racism is. So for me, I realized that I, where I stood on all of that. And so I, the whole time I lived in the U.S., and remember, I was a Canadian living in the U.S.,
yeah,
so.
That too. And could we visit again that very first time that you really stood up?
You are listening to The F Word on CFRO 102.7 FM, Vancouver's Co-op Radio, and this is an interview by WEACT, Women Elders in Action. Their website, you can go to their website at weact.vcn.bc.ca if you want to see more of the work that they're doing. And this is their interview with Bev Mill from Nelson, who was the only female freedom rider in the U.S. South during the 60s.
For what you believe in and what you saw was the very clear difference between, you know, the way the African Americans were.
Well, that incident was maybe the first real eye-opener.
Okay.
And so I started to ask black people about things, how they felt about things. And then I went to work in some hospitals while I was in the United States. And we then moved to Los Angeles, and I was working in a hospital that was run by the Episcopalian Church. And in the department that I worked in, it was strictly racist. They had black people working there, but doing only the menial work. And one day I noticed that nobody ever sat with them at lunchtime. You know, black people stayed together, white people stayed together. Nobody ever crossed that line. And I made the mistake one day of going and sitting with these black people. And I was told in no uncertain terms that if I wanted to work there, I should never do that again. So, again, you know, it was like, how many times can you be confronted with that kind of stuff and not know where you stand? And so I joined the civil rights movement, and there was a peace movement at the same time, and I was going to college, and I think the first time I ever went on a demonstration was against capital punishment. And wouldn't you know, my picture appeared on the campus newspaper. And before, I think it was only a couple of weeks from there, the FBI knocked on my door. And so that started the persecution, the labeling of me as being someone who shouldn't be opening her mouth because she wasn't a citizen, that I should keep my mouth shut if I want to live in the United States. And that harassment continued for 10 years. It never stopped. I got so that sometimes I could never work. I would only be on the job for a while, and the FBI would visit, and they would just say that I was a communist. Nobody ever gave me any opportunity to make an appeal for myself. So
How did you feel and how did you manage?
Well, I had a lot of support because, remember, I was only one person, part of a movement. Mm-hmm. You know, so we all thought alike. So I had a lot of support from the people who felt like I did, you know. And certainly, you know, it solidified for me what it meant, how dangerous it was to speak my mind. That country just didn't allow that. You know, there was something not right. This was a country that liked to say it was the most democratic country in the world, and talking about American freedom and all this stuff. Well, what I saw was the other side of it, was that it wasn't what they said it was.
And it made you stronger?
It made me stronger.
And how?
It made me angrier and stronger and more defiant, that I'm not going to let anybody tell me what to think. Mm-hmm. Or what to say. So,
where did the Freedom Riders movement start for you?
Well, the Freedom Riders movement was only lasted a year, and that was the year of 1961, where over 400 people decided to go on trains and buses to the South to test the racist laws. Mm-hmm. And they decided to go to train stations and bus stations because there was a law in the book saying you could not discriminate against people on the basis of race or color in anything that had to do with interstate commerce. But in fact, the federal government had never enforced that. And so the opportunity came up. And it was the last Freedom Ride out of 400 people who had gone to jail before me. And I thought, well, it's time for me to put myself on the line for what I believe. And at the time, I couldn't get a job. I thought, this is perfect. So we were, in fact, the last group of people, last group of Freedom Riders. And many of them had been in prison in the South. There were several that had been killed, and many of them had been beaten up very badly. Buses were burned, you know, that people took from the North to the South. So I got on a train with a group of people in Los Angeles, and we were going to Mississippi, but we were going to get off in Houston, Texas, to test a train station there where young black people, black students, had been protesting the fact that black people could not eat in that restaurant in the train station. They had to go around to the back door in the alley if they wanted to be fed. And in fact, on the train going through Texas, we saw not only black people, but Mexicans and Indian people. You could see sitting on the train, because there was a little town, right, that they would feed people out of color out the back door in the alley where the garbage was. They couldn't go inside and sit down. So, in fact, we didn't get to Mississippi. We got to Houston, Texas. We all went into the coffee shop with the local students and sat down. We were black and white people together, and we were arrested. We were told that it was unlawful assembly, and all we were doing was sitting there asking to be served. And the waitress offered to serve me, and I said, no, if you won't serve the person next to me, then I will wait until she gets her food. So they brought the paddy wagons up and read us the Riot Act and took us off to jail.
And how long were you in jail?
We were in jail for 11 days. And then we were bailed out because the jails were segregated. So I was in with the white women in prison. So they divided us not only by sex, but by race. So the black women were in with the black women, and they were considered heroes. The white women were in with the white prisoners, and we were considered like the enemy, and they threatened to kill us. And the white men were in with white men, and they were badly beaten up by the white prisoners. So they decided that we would probably get killed if they didn't take us out of jail. So they actually bailed us out at that point. And we stayed out of jail until went to trial. And I stayed in Houston, Texas until I went on trial.
At this point in your life, what were you thinking? You're so far away from everything. And you've gone so to the other side already. And
well, I had an absolutely fabulous time in jail with the prisoners. because they went from wanting to kill us, and they told us the second day we were in there that they took a vote on whether to beat us up, and that they had a majority of one that said no. So they decided not to beat us up, and so then they were curious about us. They actually came to us and asked us what we were doing, and we became quite good friends with a lot. Some of them just stayed away from us and didn't like us, but some started to talk to us, and we started reading to them. Many of the women were illiterate. They didn't know anything about anything, and they wanted to know what we were doing and why we were doing this. You know, and so that part was fun, but the being in jail, and we slept on the floor by the toilets. We had no bed. You know, it was pretty awful conditions. And the toilets were open, and the toilets were in the area where you eat. That's how primitive it was. And the toilets didn't have toilet seats on them. They were just a toilet, that's all. Four toilets in this big barred room with steel tables and benches.
And that, again, was another first experience for
me. It was, yeah. But it was scary in that we never knew what might happen to us. We were really afraid of the guards more than anything. And the guards were always trying to provoke us and telling us that they were going to take us out in pieces and things like that, you know. So it was, yeah, it was, part of the time was scary. But the interesting part of all of that is that in all these years, I had never talked about it with anybody. I went to a couple of reunions of the Freedom Riders, and we never talked about how scared we were until a couple of years ago, and somebody said, "Have any of you ever talked about how you were feeling during all of that?" And the whole time that we were waiting to be arrested when we were in the train station, we were scared. We didn't know if they were coming in with clubs to beat us over the head or what would happen to us, you know? We were in the racist south of the United States, where some of our previous Freedom Riders had been killed. Many of them had been badly beaten. So we didn't know if that was going to happen to us or not.
But actually scared, could it be the pain or the uncertainty? Or
I think it was the uncertainty of knowing that I could die, you know? I mean, that thought occurred to me. But we were so well trained and so disciplined that we never responded to violence with violence. We were stoic, and that was the thing. We were taught not to show our feelings, to just stand up for what we believed in, to link arms, and we did a lot of singing. We sang a lot of freedom songs. And that kept us going more than anything, I think. The fact that we were really solid in support of each other, you know. And we knew we were right. We knew we were right. We knew that we weren't doing anything wrong, that, you know, we were standing up for people who needed help to desegregate the South, and it took a combination of white and black people together to do that.
And as you look back now, do you see what worth you've done?
Well, I look back and I'm thinking, my God, I did something in my life that I'm really proud of. That, you know, it was quite a thing for me to do, given my background. And I knew that when I was on trial and the lawyer came in and handed me a letter from my father. And apparently the embassy had contacted my parents to tell them I was in prison. And it was a letter from my father saying how ashamed he was of me because he had a jailbird for a daughter. And that really hurt. That hurt. That was the only thing that really hurt. I could feel myself... and it hurts even now talking about it, you know. I knew that my father was racist, and somehow I didn't really expect him to support me in what I was doing. Mm-hmm. But to be in a courtroom on trial after what I'd been through and to get a letter like that, didn't care about what had happened to me. All he cared about was himself. You know, and what he saw as having a jailbird for a daughter, you know. how would he explain it to the neighbors kind of thing. And we were scared. We were scared all the time. We were scared for the 2 days on the train on the way because we were supposed to be quiet and not let anybody know who we were or what we were doing, because otherwise the press would pick up on what we were doing and they would have the police prevent us from even going in the train station. We wouldn't get a chance to. And we knew that the other freedom riders, they knew they were coming and they were waiting for them. They'd had the roads blocked, and you know, that's when they stopped the buses and took people out and beat them and lit the buses on fire. We knew that could happen to us, so we had to go for the 2 days on the train without letting anyone on the train know what we were doing. Just be looking really like quiet young people, well behaved. So whatever our fear was, we had to hold it in. And we held it in for 40-something years before we ever talked about it. So when I started talking about it and talked about how scared I was, it was like the dam bursting, you know. Mm-hmm. But I have to say I'm really proud of what I did.
How do you see what society has done so far?
Oh, sometimes I get a little discouraged to think that, well, I mean, we desegregated the South. Mm-hmm. We did. Following what we did, they couldn't refuse service to black people in trains and bus stations or planes, mm-hmm. airports. And then it started to break down in a whole lot of other ways because the government in the United States was embarrassed by the fact that they didn't enforce the laws. You know, and that was when President Kennedy was in. And they didn't want us to do this. They thought it would embarrass them. Well, it did. And we said, well, we're not going to listen to you. We're doing it anyway. And it's time that you protected people in the South. So we did accomplish something. But we didn't end racism in the United States or Canada or anywhere. You know, I mean, that's the thing, is that we talk about multicultural, we talk about multi-ethnic things, but racism exists. I mean, look at how we, I suppose the most visible example is how we treat First Nations people in this country and immigrants of color. And we know that goes on, and yet Canadians tend to sort of turn away and say, oh, I'm not racist, you know? So there's work to be done, for sure. It isn't like a big magic wand came over and made everything perfect. But it did open doors for people.
Are you doing more work on it?
Right now I'm working to help the war resistors from the United States to find sanctuary in Canada. And I'm working with a peace group in my town, and I'm also working with the Grandmothers to Grandmothers campaign with Stephen Lewis, raising money for African grandmothers to raise their grandchildren. And
you're connecting from the picture in church.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, isn't it interesting, in a circle in my life? Yeah. Yeah, it was there. It was there all the time. And when I was in Toronto meeting the African grandmothers, I was interviewed by CBC, and one of the questions they asked me was, what was it in my life that brought me to Toronto? And that's when this story came up. That was the first time I'd ever talked about it publicly. So it took a long time. It took me to be an old lady to actually talk about it, you know? And I think it needs to be talked about.
It does. It's a beautiful story.
And it wasn't just me. I mean, I was just one little person. I mean, look at what black people did who have to live in the United States and endure that all their lives. Mm-hmm. And still do, on some level. So I just did one little bit that I could do.
And have you made peace with the window that you closed in Canada?
I never got to resolve anything with my father. My father's been gone now for a lot of years, and no, he never forgave me. My mother, before she passed away, she was 94, she actually did say that she was proud of me. And I can say that I have a daughter who thinks a lot like I do and stands up for people. And I think she'll raise her children that way. So that's a big achievement right there, to think that my children believe as I do on many of those things.
So you've passed it on.
So I've passed it on. That feels good. That feels good.
And perhaps the other organizations that you're dealing with also get the values, the whatever experience you had.
Well, and when I lived in Vancouver, I was very much a part of the women's movement, the mm-hmm. women's liberation movement, and the peace movement. For years, I was on the Easter Peace Walk Committee, mm-hmm. you know, when we used to get thousands of people out demonstrating yeah. for peace, mm-hmm. which I think we need to do again.
Yes, pretty much.
Yeah, there's war, and it's expanding, and people are dying, and now Canada's drawn into the war. And I think my children believe that Canada shouldn't be in Afghanistan like I do. So yeah, that feels good to know that.
All that, perhaps those scary days, would you say that it strengthened you even more?
I think so. It gave me purpose to my life too. I didn't think like that at the time. I just knew that I was angry about the assumption that because I had a white skin that I would listen to racist comments about people. And that really upset me. That was the first thing, was that people assumed that they could say these horrible things to me. And that made me mad, because it wasn't until I was tested like that I actually was able to crystallize in myself what I believed in or didn't believe in. And I was real clear, mm-hmm. you know, what side I was on. You know, and coming from a family that didn't think like I did. So it feels like I made a shift and in lived my life pretty much as I wanted mm-hmm. to, mm-hmm. regardless of how difficult that was at times.
Mm-hmm. And you've lived up to it.
I think so. I try as much as I can, you know.
Are there any barriers to it, even now?
Well, age maybe is a bit of a barrier. I feel sometimes elderly and stiff and sore and not so inclined to go out and do things, but I do. As much as I can. I stay as involved as I can, and that's what my life is about, mm-hmm. is being active in the things I believe in. It mm-hmm. gives me hope, and it gives me purpose to my life.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The F Word on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio. This is Vancouver's only feminist radio program, and we're on the air from 7 to 9 in the morning on Saturdays. I'm Nicole Deegan. Thanks for joining me here for the last 50 minutes or so. Each week from 7 to 8, I play pre-recorded feminist material, and our second hour is the same as always, often with live interviews and discussion of current events. So what you were just listening to was an interview by WEACT with Bev Mill from Nelson, who was the only female freedom rider in the U.S. South during the 60s. And you can listen to WEACT's radio show from 4 to 5 on the fourth Wednesday of every month on CJSF 90.1 FM or CJSF.ca. And if you have any comments or thoughts on what you were hearing, feel free to drop me an email at feminisms@gmail.com. And if you'd like more information on WEACT's work, Women Elders in Action, their website is at weact.vcn.bc.ca. They do some amazing work, and right now they're doing some work documenting the stories of senior women around BC. And so if you are a senior woman, then feel free to contact them and ask about that project or take a look at their website. Again, that's weact.vcn.bc.ca. So today in Hour 2, we're going to be interviewing Elle Jones, who's a spoken word artist from Halifax, and Angela McDougall from BWSS. We're going to be talking about hip-hop and how it changed from a socially conscious act of people expressing their oppression and coming out of that oppression, and how it has turned into this kind of dreadful, sexist, misogynistic kind of force in mainstream culture. So stay tuned for that after 8 o'clock, and I'm just going to play a couple of songs leading us up to that. Thanks for listening.
This song is called Deception Island Optimist Club, and you're all honorary members as of now.
It must be awful nice living in paradise on earth. No matter what you do, all of your dreams come true, only to be replaced. So wish again, the sun is smiling, but always above you. The idea raises its head. What would I do if the earth save, or am I not quite brave enough? And we can't find our way. Just sit back and wait for the answer to appear. And you say the end is near. So rejoice, there's not much time to spare. You'll never go nowhere alone. No more nights, no more agnostic nights, sleeping one eye open to. Catch a star and tell it sweetly. I know all about you, and I, I'll never smile again. I'll never smile without you. I'll never change. I'll never grow. I'll never learn without you.
Good morning and welcome to the F Word on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. You were just listening to The Sundays with Don't Tell Your Mother. And we are the F Word Collective. I'm Amanda. I'm here with Ellie, Leslie, Nicole, and Alana. And our group is the F Word Collective, and we are committed to creating and facilitating feminist discussion and debate and promoting feminist projects and organizations. We always appreciate your suggestions and feedback, so please do write us anytime at feminisms@gmail.com. Today we'll be speaking about hip-hop and rap music, its transformation from a form of socially conscious activism into blatant expression of capitalism and sexism, and what we can do about that. We'll be speaking with Angela McDougall from Battered Women Support Services. They're hosting a screening of the film Hip-Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes with Chuck D and Byron Hurt. It is a documentary on the role of men, women, and commerce in mainstream hip-hop. You can attend this event on Friday, November 21st at the Van City Theatre at 1181 Seymour Street. The doors will be open to the public at 8:30 and the film is at 9 o'clock, followed by a panel discussion and an after party at Gallery Gachet. For more information about that event, you can go to the website at bwss.org. In the second half of the hour, we will also be speaking with Al Jones, who's a spoken word artist from Halifax and captain of the Halifax Slam team. She has performed at spoken word events across Canada, including in Vancouver, and she's also a teaching fellow at the University of King's College in Halifax.
Hi, Angela. Sorry, I thought we were going to a song. Angela, can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. That's great. So welcome to the show. Sorry about that. I was confused about what was going on, and all of a sudden you were on air. So
morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Angela is from Battered Women's Support Services, or BWSS, who's hosting the screening of Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes. Angela, can you tell us a bit about your organization to start off? What does BWSS do?
Well, it's really great to be here this morning, and thanks for the invitation. Battered Women Support Services is, we're coming up on our 30 years of feminist activism to end violence against women. And since 1979, we have been the mandate is to provide support services to women to work for social change and ultimately to end violence against women. That's the big goal. And we provide crisis support and long-term support for women. We work for law reform and other forms of systemic change, both for individual women, but then also in a broader way. And we are into prevention, which is about prevention of violence, which is about kind of changing our culture and the ways that our culture is, and also risk management for girls, to provide that information for girls.
So you do kind of public education as well as providing direct services to women and girls?
We do.
Yeah. Okay, great. And if somebody wanted to access your services or get some help or speak to one of your workers, how could they reach you?
Well, there's a couple of ways. I mean, the website's a good way to connect, and not everybody has access to the web, but that certainly is increasing. So, yeah, bwss.org. Anyone that wants information or wants support or has questions can call our crisis line, which is 604-687-1867.
Okay.
And that's in Vancouver.
Great, thank you. So about the screening of Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes, it says on the poster it's put on by BWSS and Emerge Vancouver. What's Emerge Vancouver?
Well, Emerge Vancouver is BWSS. It's just one of our initiatives. And it's our, you know, what we believe really strongly is that there is a movement in Vancouver and, you know, in the surrounding area that is about social change, and that is about recognizing the ways in which mainstream, and it's important to say mainstream hip-hop because there's always been underground, there's always been other expressions, other forms. Mainstream hip-hop has transitioned into a very monolithic, one-dimensional, stereotypical expression. And so Emerge Vancouver for us is, it's our intention to support, to, you know, take leadership from our perspective as a feminist women's organization, to take leadership, to really foster that and really support this movement. And this is why we're putting on the film.
Right. It's really interesting. We've all been quite happy to see this happening. And I think it's hard for a lot of us as feminists to see what has happened out there with a lot of the mainstream music and the hip hop and the rap music that is really intensely misogynistic, intensely, it's so blatant how dreadful it is towards women and how much it's just about money and degrading women. It's really quite shocking. And it's good to see somebody doing something to kind of actively address that. Can you tell us what you're hoping to see happen through this event?
Well, I think it's really important for us to understand, I mean, and that's why I love Byron Hurt's film, because he comes to the film, in the making of the film, as a fan of hip-hop. And it's a loving critique for him. So one of the things that we see for sure is that there's been... that hip-hop is just one cultural expression. And the mainstream hip-hop and the stuff that we've seen, that is concerning to us is one expression, and it's within a framework of other media and cultural expressions that are also misogynist and racist and homophobic. And the it's our intention to kind of fit that mainstream hip-hop into the context of other kinds of cultural expressions and other ways in which, because the film is based in the United States, Byron really breaks down the role of manhood and the role of violence and stereotypical representations of manhood in the United States. And, in Canada, we default, tremendously to those images because they're so accessible to us. And so he really breaks that down in the film, and we can see how mainstream hip-hop fits within a culture of other expressions of misogyny. And so it's our intention to not hate on hip-hop because, I was raised on hip-hop. I love hip-hop. I love the expression. I appreciate it as an oral tradition for the reasons why and how and the ways. But what we noticed in the early 1990s, and the film talks quite a bit about why this is, his kind of ideas about some of the other things that were going on in the world at that point. But in the early 1990s, what we saw was, hip hop in terms of dance and beat making and DJing, and rapping. We saw that, that one form of it became very commercialized, and that rap and the rap artist became very commercialized and became kind of the only expression that we see. And then those images became, the image that we see on the film are so, stereotypical and monolithic and very similar. Each song and each music video has a very formulaic way. And I think that for many of us as feminists or as women or even the larger community would look at that and not understand that entirely. And I think that hip-hop has gotten profoundly misunderstood. And that context, that social context for why we're seeing the things that we're seeing on the screen, was missed. And the individual rap artists, I think we all kind of have some responsibility for sure. But people are trying to make a living, trying to get by, trying to survive. And there's a very narrow funnel for which you can make a living. And so our intention, Battered Women Support Services, is to, we always have grand ideas. Our intention is to, bring the context and show the film, bring this context, to hip hop, and have discussions about manhood, about the role of media in representations of manhood, and the role of media in representations of women. I mean, I don't think that media causes violence against women, but I think that it does desensitize us, and I think that it does, because we're seeing all kind of, these expressions, and we're seeing these images, and it desensitizes us to particularly mainstream because we're, women. As you probably know, there's really only one way that men relate to women within hip-hop, mainstream hip-hop videos. There's only one way that women are represented. That's the only, kind of way is very sexualized and objectified and so much a dime a dozen. I mean, there's usually 20 or 30 women, and they're all women of color, which is another piece. Like the intersection of race in terms of the social context and how mainstream hip hop has created, and how commerce, is selling an urban experience, is really selling an African American urban experience, and that, the film talks about who's actually purchasing the film, who's selling the film, and who's selling the music, and who's purchasing the music is primarily white audiences.
Mm-hmm.
there's all these things that are concerning. So it's our intention to just really have that discussion as a city, you know, and let's look at representations of manhood. Let's look at representations of womanhood, and let's think about how this is affecting us as girls and as boys and as young men, young women, as adults. Let's think about how we can foster cultural expressions that are affirming, because they are there. And so the filmmaker will be there, and Chuck D will be there, and you know, Chuck is a cultural icon, and he he's thinking about this stuff. It has been for a long time, and you know, and Byron made the film.
Yeah, it's amazing to think of the opportunity to go there and actually discuss those things and have them weigh in on it. I was going to bring my son. He's 17, and maybe some other teenagers. Can you tell us a little bit about? I read on there that there's a time when it's for youth and a time when it's for adults. Or I couldn't quite understand the schedule on the Friday. Can you explain that a little bit so that if anybody else wants to bring their teenagers, they know when to do that?
Sure. So the film has been rated in BC as 14 accompanied, and due to course and language. I mean, it's a documentary, and there's a kind of a recognition that there's a social benefit for the film. So we wanted to have youth shows because we wanted to have particular times when youth could be be youth. We have some of our other panelists during the youth shows are youth. And so we wanted to have just time for youth to look at what youth, hear what youth are saying. Youth in terms of girls and as boys. I mean, because so the youth shows are in the morning, and then we have the public show in the evening. And the public show is just that. I mean, it's open, and the doors open at 8:30, and tickets are. I mean, the film is at 9, and tickets are are on sale for that. And so the public show is really. It's a fundraiser for us, but it's also an opportunity for people to hear from Chuck and to hear from Byron and to see this film, and so youth can come. I mean, 14 accompanied is what it's rated at, and
oh, okay.
And so we have over 300 youth that are coming in the morning, and we're really looking forward to having them participate.
That sounds amazing. Well, great. Thank you so much for speaking with us about this morning. We're really excited about this project. So again, it's a screening of Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes. And there's going to be a discussion afterwards with Chuck D and Byron Hurt, who's the filmmaker. It's a documentary on the role of men, women, and commerce in mainstream hip hop. And it's on Friday, November 21st at Van City Theater, 1181 Seymour Street. The doors open at 8:30 and the film is at 9. And there's a panel discussion after the film and an after party at Gallery Gache. For more information, you can go to bwss.org. And Angela, before we go, is there anything you want to say in closing?
Well, I think that we can just continue to look at the ways in which the contributing factors of violence, which is how we are socialized in part. I mean, how we're socialized as women and as men, how we practice gender. And as an organization that is about ending violence, we see the very worst, that humans do to humans and that men do to women. And we are encouraged by the outpouring of support that the public has shown for us in terms of showing this film, the schools, how interested that people are to have this discussion. And so we're really encouraged by the possibilities that we have on the 21st to have this conversation as a city and the change that can happen once we are brave enough to explore this stuff. And I appreciate the F word for having me here this morning.
Oh, we are more than happy to have you here, and we're really excited about this event, and thank you so much for all your excellent work at BWSS and on this project. We're really excited we're going to be there.
That's great.
All right. You have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Angela.
Bye.
You're listening to The F Word on CFRO 102.7 FM.
Young Lula, baby. Yeah. Go. So exquisite, I'm so exquisite. She like my swag and the way that I glisten. Yeah. So exquisite, I'm so exquisite. I spent your house at the Diamond District.
Look at my neck. Don't that bitch go bling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling. Get my respect. Father, I do my motherfucking thing. I'm a king. You should kiss my pinky ring. Bitch, I'm a king. I know what I'm doing.
I'm so exquisite, so exquisite.
Pop, she like my swag and the way that I glisten.
So exquisite, I'm so exquisite. Get rubber bands at the Diamond District. So exquisite, I'm so exquisite.
She like my swag and the way that I glisten.
So exquisite. I'm so exquisite.
Tiger.
I spent your house at the Diamond District.
I'm so ES. Never quit it. Nope. Admit it. Yep. I'm on. Duh. Like a Civic. Get it. Don't get it. Forget it. My city. Wanna fit it. Okay. CBT. Little Mikey. That's me. Now switch it. Tiger. Separate from them like a divider. I'm the type of love that they don't like. One nighter. All you get like Ryu. Street Fighter. But don't scuff the knife. It's the dime. So
exquisite. I'm so exquisite.
She like my swag and the way that I glisten.
I'm so exquisite. I'm so exquisite. I spent your house at the Diamond District. I'm so exquisite. I'm so exquisite. The hoes wanna know my digits. I'm so exquisite. I'm so exquisite.
Yeah.
I spent your house at the Diamond District.
Hey yo, who am I? Wait, I am he. Who to you is the best thing that you ever seen? I'm red on the market. I am not a target, and I'm moving at a speed that no car can hit. And you can check my background, bitch, I'm super legit. And you can have this lifestyle, cause I'm through with this shit. And no matter how you put it, I've been doing this shit. GD, I ain't see the sign, moving my shit.
I'm so exquisite, I'm so exquisite.
She likes my swag and the way that I glisten.
I'm so exquisite, I'm so exquisite. I spent your house at the Diamond District. I'm so exquisite. I'm so exquisite. The digit hoes wanna know my digits. I'm so exquisite. I'm so exquisite. That's the joke at the Diamond District.
Never finish, nope. I go pronto to the gasoline low. Gasoline flow, level game O-B-R. No words, sir, mister. Just enjoying your work. Your salary lies on my shirt. 9 to 5, I'm out of sight. Outside, out of borderline. Poly sky, traveling super high. Oh, there goes a fly. Super fly tiger guy. Young money, getting every dollar right.
Welcome back to the F Word. That was an example of terrible music. So, well, not that it was terrible musically, but the lyrics. So we were, just to let you know that we're not necessarily promoting that song. We were just wanting to give an example of some of the stuff that's out there and the way that these artists are speaking about themselves and about women and about money and their music and how scary it is. So anyways, you're listening to the F Word on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, and you can learn more about our work at feminisms.ca. And after I think we're gonna play a couple of songs that aren't scary, and then we're gonna come back and speak with Elle Jones, who's a spoken word artist in Halifax. And thank you again to Angela McDougall from BWSS, who we just spoke with for a little while. Thanks.
We don't want Chinamen in Canada. This is a white man's country, and white men will keep it so.
The people of Canada do not wish to make a fundamental alteration in the character of our population. Large-scale immigration from the Orient would change the fundamental composition of the Canadian population.
You know, when you listen to history, it's his story. He's telling us what he wants us to know. It's his story, it's not our story. He's telling us what he wants us to know. It's his story, it's not our story.
The government passed special legislation which fixed the tax of $50 on every Chinese entering the country. The head tax was raised to $100, and eventually in 1903 to $500.
We suffer political oppression, economic exploitation, and social degradation, all of them from the same enemy. The government has failed us. You can't deny that.
And nobody cared, and nobody wondered, and nobody understood. Nobody cared, and nobody wondered, and nobody understood.
Vancouver seethed with racial hatred. An Asiatic Exclusion League was formed. In 1887, Vancouver workers rioted in an anti-Chinese protest. Vancouver seethed with racial hatred. An Asiatic Exclusion League was formed. Any Oriental encountered was beaten mercilessly. An anti-Chinese protest.
An old woman can sit. An old man. A chump can sit. A coward can sit. Anything can sit. Well, you and I have been sitting long enough, and it's time today for us to start doing some standing.
Yourself Chinese, or do you ever think of yourself as North American?
You know what I want to think of myself as? A human being.
This is for all my queens and queens, and all my kings in Kingston raising a baby in Babylon. If all of the sisters could fight for the brothers instead of fighting over the brothers, and all of the brothers could try to love their own instead of trying to own love, then maybe we could fight like X did instead of fighting our exes. And maybe if for a minute we stopped hating each other, we could do like Haiti and free each other. And ladies, ask Harriet Tubman what it should mean to railroad each other instead of selling each other out. We saw the soul in each other. And brothers, we need to stop pimping black women like we learned from Massa and be more like Selassie instead of selling asses. We used to go broke to go to school. Now we'd rather go broke than go to school. We were out in the hot fields dying to be cool. Now we're out in the streets dying to be cool, so we spend our last cent on those sweatshop shoes. We take our government check, but we don't check our government. We'll vote for American Idol, but not the president. So while our brothers sit idle and sing, sing, we don't care if our idols can sing, sing. And because we were sold to make sugar in Barbados and Bahamas, now we talk about getting those sugar daddies and sugar mamas. And when we talk about dead presidents, we mean cash and not Obama. We're all up in each other's business, but we can't get up in each other's businesses, and then we wonder why we still don't own shit. Instead of building like Egypt, we try to jip each other, and we'll rip each other off before we tip each other, and then we say, don't trip, brother. So we give each other props for still being property, and we fill our heads with hip-hop, but never with philosophy, and we buy anything unnecessary instead of by any means necessary. Black men call their home their crib, like they're so busy being children they can't raise their kids. And they call their woman their baby mama, but never give her that ring. We used to have to run away from the dogs so we could get married. Now we run away to be dogs instead of being called daddy. And because we used to feel the crack of the whip, now we sell crack to buy new whips. And instead of getting that diploma, we'd rather dip. So instead of working in that office and wearing a white collar, we get collared by white offices just to make that dollar. We want to play above the rim so we can buy new rims instead of taking engineering and building that pyramid. We know everything about Judge Mathis and nothing about what math is. We're so used to being money, we've forgotten what cash is, and we can make that bank shot, but we don't know where the bank is. Because we're told we can play in the NBA, but we can't be an MBA, and we can be an MC, but not an MD or an MA, and we don't talk about racism, we just talk about player hating. We dream about going to Liberia, but we can't go to the library, so we're at our rights when we're sentenced instead of writing that sentence. We come from people who wrote the book of the dead. Now we either end up booked or dead. And maybe if we hung by our necks like our grandparents did, we wouldn't talk so hard about choking a bitch. And if we ever had to cut a lynching victim down, we'd think twice before we cut each other down to size, and maybe that's why we call each other shorty. We talk about shooting each other with 9s and 45s, but we don't talk about working that 9 to 5. I guess we spent so long on the auction block, but now we'd rather die than get off the block. So we end up on a chain gang in that jail, because when we join that gang, we can buy that chain, so we kill each other over shorting that way, just like Master did when he put cotton on the scale. Ask a slave to show you a hoe. Do you think he'd point at his sister in the next cotton row, or the tool in his hand used to make the cotton grow? And when he sees the overseer come and ask him what it means to get low, ask him to point out free black people, I bet he'd never say BET. And brother, I don't think he'd say you. And sister, I don't think he'd say me.
Okay, welcome back to the F Word. What you just heard was a clip of L. Jones performing at the Africville Reunion in Halifax this summer. So, and before that, we had No Luck Club, which is a local Vancouver act. So we have L on the phone right now, and we're going to talk to her a little bit about our topic as well. So, hi, L, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Not too bad. We're so excited to have you on the show this morning. Yeah, that performance just gives me chills every time I hear it. So I guess to get started, our listeners can learn a little bit more about you. So how did you get started writing and performing spoken word?
Well, I always wrote poetry, but it's a bit of a strange story because I think at university and just at my work, I was sort of suffering from a lot of racism, and it gets depressing. And in response, I would start listening to a lot of music to kind of just hear black voices in my day. So to, you know, hear Lauryn Hill, I sort of start my day off, at least I can hear her talking to me and singing to me. So I guess I had all of that in my head, and I woke up one morning and I just had a poem, which has never happened to me, like straight, all the rhymes, everything. I didn't have to do anything to it. So I kind of wrote it out, and then I was like, well, what do I do with this? I can't rap, so, you know, I don't know what this is. And then literally the next day, I saw someone on the street, and they were like, how come you never come out to poetry? And it's tonight, and you should come. So I was like, okay. So I went, and I decided to read it on the open mic, and it went from there.
Wow. So your work's obviously very political and speaks to sort of your experience and collective experience. Why do you feel that spoken word and hip-hop have been used as such powerful tools of political activism?
Well, I think, I mean, the origins of hip-hop came out of I mean, the Bronx, where it was the high unemployment, the heavy, when that community was really, really depressed. So people made out of nothing, hip-hop, you know, so you could make beats with your mouth. Mm-hmm. Grandmaster Flash was looking through the garbage, and he found a, to make the fade, you know, he found an off-on switch, and he rewired it sideways to make the fade for record players. It's still on every record player today. So it was people who had nothing using their own creativity. You know, if we don't have instruments, we don't have money for that, but we can use our own voices. So its roots are already political, you know what I mean? Because it's people mm-hmm. that were responding to immense poverty and immense oppression and using, you know, their own human skills to rise out above that, which is what black people have always done, right, from the mm-hmm. beginning of slavery.
Absolutely.
So it has that, I think, that connection. It's connected to the oral culture. And, I mean, it's not just black, obviously. I mean, spoken word, there's a lot of gay people that do it because, obviously, they're also responding to a lot of things in their lives. A lot of women will speak about feminist issues. So I think it tends to attract people that have something to say and people who really have something to say, often people that feel a pressure of being silent.
Absolutely. So it's kind of giving a space to marginalized voices.
I think so, yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's not exclusively that. I mean, a lot of people, I mean, Shane Coizen is a famous Canadian poet, and but I mean, on the other hand, he's overweight, so maybe that, you know, who knows what motivates people, but I think particularly that idea of, you know, if you're slamming to have 3 minutes to say something, that's really motivating. You have to really think, but yeah, I have something to say to do that, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, we've been talking a lot about how hip-hop was born of experience of oppression and a desire to reclaim a space and then how it shifted to this mainstream culture of racism and sexism and consumerism. So what are your thoughts on this issue?
I think the first thing to understand is that hip-hop didn't create these things. It reflects it in a wider society.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not like misogyny got started when Dr. Dre dropped his first album.
Absolutely.
So, you know, things that happen in the black community also reflect things that happen in the wider mainstream community. So mm-hmm. there's been a rise, I think, of those things in our general community that is reflected back into the black community. But I think when we're thinking about hip-hop, the first thing is, of course, we lost control of it. When you look at early hip-hop, it wasn't mainstream, but for that reason, it was people like Chuck D. You know, it was these young black men that were self-empowering themselves through their voices. And, of course, the more it gets sold out to record labels and to interest, then you know, those mainstream names just want to make it into party music. That's what Dead Prez says, right? Yeah, I know it's part of their plans to make us think it's all about party and dance, you know. So it's once we sell out those experiences to other people to make money, it's going to come back through money, right? So I think that's the first thing. The second thing is, of course, that I think misogyny is a reflection of violence, and racism is violence. So when our men suffer violence in their lives, it gets reflected onto the women in the community, which is something that Malcolm X talked about, right, that black men don't respect themselves because they're not taught to respect themselves in a mainstream society, so then how do they respect black women? So then they reflect back attitudes from the mainstream society about blackness onto the woman. So it's, I think, a lot of ways a function of racism. So it's not to be, I mean, we have to take responsibility for it in our communities, but I think it's a reflection of an overall kind of racism that does violence to black people, that causes us to do violence to ourselves.
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the most problematic things about critiques of hip-hop is it's often sort of comes from this idea that it's inherently misogynistic when it completely overlooks the experience of racism and sort of where that comes from. And I mean, and that's really tricky for someone to sit in a position of privilege and critique an experience and label it as violence without a thorough understanding of kind of where that experience comes from.
And I mean, in terms of, I mean, Eminem said some of the worst things I've ever heard, that people were comfortable calling him a genius.
Yeah.
No black person ever said something like, you know, your mother's a bitch, when talking in a song to a child. No black person ever did that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they might call other women, but nobody ever called their mother something, you know, no black person would do that. But because Eminem was drawing upon what he saw as a kind of anger and then sort of corrupting that further, but that was okay because he was white, and white people aren't seen as being pathological in the same way that black males are.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, it's put onto black people, but yeah, it's also a reflection of the fear of black males in society. So people will, I mean, I've said this before, but everyone complains about hip-hop, but we don't talk about how disgusting it is to watch Donald Trump firing people on TV at a time when unemployment and poverty is, you know, these are the greatest problems. That's what creates the ghettos. Unemployment, people not being able to get jobs. We don't see that as a violence, that we all sit down and watch people losing their jobs, right?
Absolutely. It's a complete contradiction in our society, and that we can pick and choose kind of the issues we're going to critique. Mm-hmm. So I guess I would ask you, what do you think we can do to challenge some of the violent messages without imposing censorship or without imposing kind of these racist judgments on hip-hop? Do you think there's something activists can do to reclaim the political roots of hip-hop?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. that's sort of a large question, because it's sort of the how do we defeat racism. I mean, there also are a lot of people out there, I think there has been a movement already, people like Mos Def, people like Common, Kanye West sometimes, but, you know, Talib Kweli, there's a lot of conscious hip-hop out there, and I think part of it is people being willing to participate in that market, because it's also what people want to be sold. Mm-hmm. 75% of hip-hop is bought by white suburban people.
Yeah.
So part of it is that it's people that want to experience what they think is real life through hearing these stories about, you know, being shot or whatever, but that's what the market is for. If people themselves want a conscious market, the conscious market will return to them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's partly giving artists, and there's so many out there. I mean, local artists, you know, people that are doing that work, it's being willing to listen to female voices. I mean, what happened to the woman in hip-hop? There were a lot. Now there's not really any. Latifah's coming out with a new album, but I think she's kind of passed her sell-by date, so I don't know. But, you know, like, so encouraging female voices, like being willing to sort of suspend the stereotypes of what you want to hear when you listen to black music, because I think people think when it's my time to listen to hip-hop, I want to listen to party music and I want to hear this kind of thing. And they don't think that they want to listen to the serious music, take it as serious art, which should encourage, I think, more political voices.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like looking further for that music that represents those marginalized voices and goes back to talking about serious issues and going past kind of the top 40 stuff and really looking for political music.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, it's sort of people like to slum with black stuff a lot. So, you know, people like to sort of speak fake Ebonics and, you know, oh, it's so funny to pretend to be black. And then that image of blackness gets reflected, which is a very trivialized and dangerous image of blackness that doesn't reflect the true experiences of black people. And that's one thing we're happy about with Obama, you know, to see Michelle out there.
Yeah.
And to see her, and she's an atypical black woman in the sense of she's Michelle Obama, but she's not atypical for many, many women in the community that are mothers and professional women and are strong like that. And so that's one image that's out there that hopefully will get people to understand that, you know, what you see on a music video doesn't reflect us.
Absolutely.
You know, that kind of positive image. And it's our responsibility to increase our visibility that way, but it's also, you know, the other side of the responsibility is to stop asking us to be and stop narrowing us down, that to realize that, you know, the black community has much more to offer than this very narrow and cartoon version of ourselves, you know. And people want that because, you know, that's entertainment, right? That's what entertainment is, to watch other people humiliate themselves. you know, it's our responsibility, ultimately, as a community. And, you know, we have to work on self-empowerment and our own relationships. This is what I say at the beginning of that poem, you know, if we fought for each other instead of over each other, you know, and that's on us. But it's also on other people to stop offering us money to degrade ourselves, right?
Absolutely. Okay, well, we're going to have to wrap up, but is
okay.
I was going to say, is there anything else in closing that you'd like our listeners to know on your thoughts on the topic?
No, I don't know. I mean, I think that just ultimately, I mean, we're in a shared enterprise together. I mean, listener and speaker. You can't be a speaker without a good listener. So for those who speak, I suppose, you know, speak with dignity and speak with responsibility, and those who listen in the same way, and then, you know, hopefully we'll get somewhere good.
Absolutely. and about your work, is there any upcoming shows in Vancouver or anything?
You have to ask Gruffmouth about that. February, I know he's having, he has an African slam and a film festival, so I might come out for that if I can, but people should definitely check out the Vancouver Poetry Slam. There's a lot of amazing stuff going on there, and spoken word, I think, is always the cutting edge for political speech, for responsible speech. So I can't remember who they are, a Café du Soleil, I think. But people should definitely go see them on Mondays. So.
Mondays at Café du Soleil here in Vancouver?
Yeah.
Great. And is there a website for Halifax Slam or for any of your
work? Have Facebook stuff, Word is Bond, the Speak series, so people can Facebook that. They can also Facebook me, L. Jones, or read books, any people like that. We're sort of supposed to be working on our MySpace, but we never get around to it.
Mm-hmm.
But look up Word is Bond with a Z. Word is Bond, Halifax Speak Series. You can find out what we're doing from there.
Okay.
And anyone who's listening from Halifax, me and Israel are featuring this Thursday at Ginger's.
Great.
At 9 p.m.
Great. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us, Elle. Thank you. So that was Elle Jones. She's a spoken word artist from Halifax. So I definitely encourage listeners to check out more about Elle's spoken word online, I guess through Facebook, and about the Halifax Slam team and about spoken word events going on here in Vancouver. And stay involved in the political activism of spoken word. So we're going to go to a quick break, and we come back, we'll be wrapping up our conversation on hip hop. So you've been listening to The F Word on CFRO 102.7 FM. It's Vancouver's co-op radio in the downtown east side. For more information on the show or our work, please check out our website at feminisms.ca or email us at feminisms with an S at gmail.com. So we're going to take a quick musical break and we'll be back.
From the brutality of the civil war in northern Uganda and the grave abuses at Abu Ghraib prison to violence against women in Afghanistan and the Congo, the Amnesty International Film Festival covers the world when it comes to exposing violations of human rights and the struggle to restore human dignity. Join us for 35 films that span the globe and stir the conscience, November 13th to the 16th at Van City Theater, 1181 Seymour Street. Program and advance tickets at tickets tonight.ca, brought to you in part by Co-op Radio.
from that express.
Up the Soviet Union to Russia.
Welcome back. You've been listening to The F-Word on CFRO 102.7. That was Mecha Normal with Once, and before that was Crystal Castles with Crime Wave. Yes, you're listening to Vancouver's Co-op Radio. For more information on our show and our work, check out our website at feminisms.ca or email us at feminisms@gmail.com. We want to thank our guests again, Angela McDougall and Elle Jones. Don't forget to come to Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes with BWSS, Chuck D, and Byron Hurt. It is a documentary on the role of men, women, and commerce in mainstream hip hop. You can attend this along with us on Friday, November 21st at Van City Theater at 1181 Seymour Street. The doors open at 8:30 and the film is at 9, followed by the panel discussion and an after party at Gallery Gachet. For more information, go to bwss.org. So join us every Saturday morning at 8 o'clock here on Co-op Radio or listen live on www.cooperadio.org. Again, that website for us is www.feminisms.ca. Please stay tuned for Red Eye, an independent and in-depth programming on culture, politics, and activism. They're on next and every Saturday from 9 in the morning until noon. Thanks again for listening to The F Word, and have a great weekend.
Scratching at your door.